Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of The Laydown. I'm Ryan, my pronouns are she, her, and my guest for this episode is Bill Weir. Bill Weir is a veteran anchor, writer, producer, and host who came to CNN in 2013 after a decade of award-winning journalism at ABC News. He's written a book on climate change called Life as We Know It Can Be, which is out now. In this book, Weir takes readers through time and around the world to confront the biggest climate threats to life as we know it, digging into fascinating corners of history, psychology, technology, and his own biography to connect the lessons he's collected from the happiest, healthiest, and most resilient societies. In a wide search for practical ways to protect nature, communities, and our mental health in the face of frightening change, he highlights the groundbreaking innovation in fields of clean energy, food, and housing, and introduces us to the people who have dedicated their lives to fight climate change. Inspired by a series of Earth Day letters he began writing his newborn son in 2020, Weir addresses the worry and wonder of climate change and offers a strong message of hope that a better future can still be written. Part travel, adventure, environmental science book, and memoir, Life as We Know It Can Be is a celebration of the wonders of our planet, a meditation on the human wants and needs that drive it out of balance, and an inspiration for communities to galvanize around nature and each other as the very best way to prepare and plan for what's next. Now, I did record this in the middle of the bookstore, so you will hear some background conversations between customers and booksellers a couple of times during the interview, but they don't last very long and they're not super loud, and hey, that's just part of the ambiance of the bookstore. Now, on to the interview. Hi, Bill Weir. How are you?
I'm really well, Ryan. How are you?
I'm so great. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me in.
Oh my gosh, my pleasure. I am so excited about your book, which we will get into in great detail shortly. But I tend to catastrophize when it comes to things like climate change. And so when I found out that you were writing a hopeful book about climate change, I was like, this is for me.
Well, I'm glad you have such an open spirit. I would be like, okay, cynically, what are you... What scam is this? Or what drugs is he on?
What are you ignoring? But so we will get more into the content of your book shortly. But I wonder if, for the listeners, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey to this book.
Absolutely. So it's long and circuitous. I'm a Midwestern kid born in Milwaukee, but my mom at a very early age became a very sort of zealous evangelical and announced at breakfast one day that God had told her in a dream that we should leave Milwaukee and move to Texas so she could be a televangelist. And so we did, and the dreams kept coming. So I went to 17 different schools in 6 states growing up. Across the Bible Belt mostly, but I would spend my summers and Christmases with my dad, who is an atheist outdoorsman, completely different worldview than my mom, and I'd sort of pendulum between these very different places, and turned out to be great training for a job in journalism. When you're always the new kid, you learn how to read a room and empathize with folks, and I fell in love with storytelling, you know, growing up, you know, newspapermen I revered. I thought I either want to be David Letterman or Peter Jennings, the news anchor. And I started my career trying to be a sort of a smart ass sportscaster. I started in little markets and would just do funny highlights. And then sort of the novelty of TV wore off after a while. I worked my way up from Chicago to LA, and I was sort of bored with doing sports, even especially when 9/11 happened and they sent me home for a couple weeks. And I really loved the news, but I didn't think I'd have a path back to it. Spent a year out in Hollywood just writing scripts and being a cliche. And then Good Morning America came calling. They'd seen my work on a morning show, and I got hired at the network and spent a decade there and at Nightline, and just blew my mind with international travel and a chance to see different cultures and experience new things. And I fell in love with international reporting then, came to CNN. I did a series called The Wonder List, in which I went to the wonders of the world and wondered what would be left of them for my daughter when she turns my age in the year 2050. So we filmed that in almost 36 countries, 4 seasons of that show. And then in 2016, the things changed politically. CNN menu changed a little bit for obvious reasons. And they wanted to create a climate desk. And I had sort of resisted being pigeonholed with a beat. I'm a generalist, but I realized that climate sort of includes all the beats. It's economics and foreign policy and healthcare and food and travel and transportation and shelter. And anyway, I leapt at that opportunity and spent the first couple of years catastrophizing things, much like you. Sounds like we're kindred spirits. And I got very dark because I was really immersed in the science. And it's just, and when you talk to these scientists, you know, especially after they let their guard down a little bit and show you how scared they are about the changes. And I was supposed to, oh, and then basically at that point in 2020, my daughter was 16 years old. I'd been doing climate for a couple of years and had a new family. I'd gone through a divorce, which added to the darkness before that. And then, but my new partner, who really wanted to become a mother, didn't think she could. We got pregnant and this little boy came along, much to our delight. And I had a second sort of chance at parenting, but it was in a completely different headspace than when I made the Wonder List, and so much had changed in the world. And so I started writing these Earth Day letters to my son. I don't know, romantically, he might read them, you know, when he's old enough to ask the big questions or whatever, but they were sort of cathartic letters of apology for the planet we broke for you, but also letters of welcome. I'm so glad you're here. Mr. Rogers taught me that when you see something scary on TV, look for the helpers. This book is dedicated to the helpers. I think he's going to be a helper, you know? And really, I just came at it at the beginning as sort of a practical guide to how to live on this planet we accidentally wrecked and, you know, where to live, where are the havens? You know, what kind of home should you build? What will your food supply look like, you know, as you grow up? What are the smart choices to make to connect yourself with community? And those letters really expanded into the idea that life as we know it is ending, for better or worse, but life as we know it can be, is already being proven around the world to build more resilient, connected, sustainable, strong societies that are stronger because of these things, come what may. We don't know what's coming next. We don't know how this new planet works that we've made. But we do know that the tools are already in our hands to use and live in much smarter, healthier ways.
Yeah. I love the framework of this book, and that it's, you have that opening, that's that really beautiful letter to your son, which made me cry because I also had a child in 2020. And I was like, okay. Oh,
yeah. Yep. Yeah, you can relate.
This all feels very familiar. but yeah, no, I love the framework that you are kind of writing this book to your son and to that generation,
right,
of like, things can change and we can adapt. And I was really struck by, there's an example you give that I think it was maybe your dad was showing you, where he was like, hold out your arm. That's the life of the world. And now, like, take a nail file and scrape your finger twice and like you've erased human history. And I was like, that's it's so hard to conceptualize that. But yeah, we're a blip. Like,
yeah. And that's the thing. We have no concept of Earth time, you know, that, you know, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, which is just too many zeros for our Homo sapien brains to really consider. But if we scale that down to 45 years, like a 45-year-old house,
right?
The Himalayas were installed 5 years ago. Mm. Humans showed up 3 months ago in Earth time. And the Industrial Revolution is 60 seconds ago. And in that time, we have changed the chemistry of the sky and the sea and altered the shape of animals, shortened the wings of birds and melted so much ice, it shifted the North Pole 15 feet. Like, you know, we just, and it doesn't seem like we have that capacity, but wow, we do. And we don't appreciate that the things that are being wrecked took millions of years to settle into this Goldilocks little blue marble. And again, I think a big arching theme of the book is that we're made of stories, really. Mm-hmm. And the stories we tell ourselves about time and our impact and all that. But stories are always changing. you know, and flags and borders and religions and corporations are under constant revision. And we can change the story for the better in rapid ways, more surprising than sometimes people think.
Yeah. And so one of the things that you talk about right in the beginning of the book is you kind of re-examine the Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because I found that a fascinating way to look at things.
Thank you. Yeah. I really was just, when I started out writing this, it's my first book. I write for TV, so it's for the ear and for the eye, not for the page to be read. And so much different challenge, and I was really struggling with it. And I sort of really widen the aperture and take it way back. Like, what is the problem? What caused what this mess we're in? Because I meet so many amazing humans, and I'm, you know, I have such, it's such a dichotomy of they can be such incredible people and can so be so evil in one from one moment to the next. We have that capacity. But really, our problems are made by our definitions of wants and needs and the stories we tell ourselves about wants and needs. And when you start looking into human motivation, you can't help but land on this amazing guy named Abraham Maslow, who was a son of Ukrainian Jewish immigrants, had a brutal childhood. His mother, he described her as a monster who just tortured his siblings and was a racist and cruel. And so he would escape in the library, and brilliant guy, and excelled in academia, studied sort of ape dominance at Wisconsin, went up and did field work with the Blackfoot tribe in Canada, and wrote this, all his, distilled his ideas down in an article in 1939 called A Theory on Human Motivation. And he doesn't use the pyramid shape, but that's how pop culture sort of absorbed these ideas. And if you picture that sort of triangle or a pyramid with five layers, the stuff at the bottom, your physiological needs, we all need these just to function. Air, water, temperature close to 68 degrees, minerals, excretion, sleep. If you don't meet those needs, nothing else matters. Level two is your safety needs, your shelter, rule of law, information, and economy are all safety needs. The stuff that essentially breaks down when I go cover a hurricane is, you know, the first two layers of the pyramid are suddenly at risk.
Yeah.
And then, but if your belly is full and the door is barred and you feel safe, level three is love. You want to belong to a partner or a tribe. Level four is esteem needs. You want to feel respected within the social construct. And then at the time, he put the tip of the pyramid is self-actualization, the idea that you can be whatever you were meant to be. And his vision for this was like, if we create a peace table, this, you know, a few months after he published this, Hitler invades Poland, right? And he wrote this paper at a time of peaceful abundance and says so, that emergency conditions are rare. And he dreamed for a peace table where if we just understood each other's motivations, maybe Hitler is hungry and is not loved, and you know, and we can nudge him in a different, more productive way than doing what he's doing. You know, like this, he had this sort of Pollyannish idea, but people instead use this, marketing executives use the pyramid of needs to figure out different buttons to push to sell us stuff. And hippies used it to justify, or baby boomers, to go from the Woodstock mud to boardrooms and do whatever they wanted to do. I'm just being self-actualized, you know?
Right.
And I just found it a beautiful sort of framing device, because I never thought about air or water or shelter growing up. You know,
right.
I worked,
yeah.
I took all those things for granted. We weren't rich, but I never doubted I was going to eat. And I didn't think about the quality of my air. I didn't know it was thanks to the Clean Air Act, you know,
right.
Because
right. Yeah.
Right. When I am old enough to remember when you could see the air in Los Angeles and the fires, you know, the rivers were on fire in Ohio, and those things changed. But just to, now that we're no longer in an age of peaceful abundance, when emergency conditions are no longer rare, how do we think about these things? And in the end, the way I came away with, just from studying sort of the most content, happiest, healthiest people that I've met doing the Wonder List, from the blue zones in Korea where they live to 100 at a crazy rates, or Vanuatu, which is perennially among the happiest countries, Bhutan. These are all the things they have in common, is that they're super connected with each other and their nature, where they are. They eat in the seasons. They move throughout the landscapes. They all have a sense of purpose. Their sense of nature around them is reverent, you know? and made me realize that maybe in the US, the story we were telling ourselves about how to fill our pyramid of needs certainly wasn't filling mine. Consumption wasn't doing it. But connecting with neighbors around, you know, growing our food, connecting around our soils, understanding what's in the air, I argue, can fill those needs in ways that social media likes can't, or, you know, cruises or vacations or new shoes can't, you know, and those things are all great. But your generation, my daughter now who's 20, and then of course River, my little boy, he's growing up, and we've just created this golden age of addiction and depression and distraction because we've made sort of human contact optional, you know, the kind of collaboration that our species depended on for thousands of years. I don't even need to look the guy in the eye who brings me a 5-star meal, you know, through an app and drops it off at my door. And I just sort of wanted, and I'm as guilty as anybody as getting sucked into that sort of culture of comfort. But I think we're in for some hard times. There's some pain that's baked into what's coming. But we can rally around each other and nature and at least lessen the pain and help those who can't adapt the way we can.
Yeah, it's interesting. Definitely, you know, working a public facing job, and of course, like the vast majority of people who are shopping in an indie bookstore are wonderful, beautiful people, right? But there are times when you're like, oh, you don't see me as a fellow person. I'm just the faceless thing behind the register that's conducting the transaction. Like, there's this weird phenomenon that has happened, right, with humanity, where it's just like, I am the main character of my own story and everybody else is just NPCs. They don't matter.
It's like, what? You're just a functionary in my video game, you know? I think the pandemic really, we forgot how to be people with each other. We forgot how to pass each other in hallways and, you know, and whether to look away or stop and chat. And, and I know, I don't know how it was for you, but I know my daughter, you know, suffered for lack of that social contact, and we didn't know any better, right? Again, and so history is full of the pain of unintended consequences when it made sense to close down schools the way we did or whatever, you know, and not realizing there are costs to all of these decisions going forward, right? But the worst thing we can do is not talk about them, especially the big challenges. And the thing that I found encouraging as looking for signs of hope was this term called pluralistic ignorance, which is the wrong impression of the rest of your countrymen and women. And in 2022, researchers from Yale and some other places surveyed Americans and said, just guess what percentage of your fellow Americans care about climate, care about an earth and balance and doing something about it. And most people, regardless of party, guessed between 33% and 40%. And in fact, it was 66% to 80%.
Oh, wow.
You know, you think you're outnumbered 2 to 1. The opposite is true. You're surrounded by allies you don't know you have because nobody's talking about the climate. You know, it's just, it's been politicized and demonized and, you know, demagogued. You don't want to be the buzzkill at drop-off with your kids. You don't want to be the wah-wah, you know, at a party. Because we don't, I don't think we know how to talk about it yet, you know? And because we don't talk about the psychology around it, how complicated it is, the guilt or the anger. And I actually draw on Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and the 5 stages of grief just to connect with people and understand. I understand why you're in denial. I understand why you're bargaining, you know, you think we can engineer. And to be empathetic to all of those emotions. But maybe the conversation starts a drop off with, you know, I just read something about electric school buses. Wouldn't that be cool if, like, we weren't all breathing these diesel fumes right here? And if we could then plug the school into the bus at night and use it as a, you know, light up. That'd be cool, right? You know, and so Dr. King, Dr. Martin Luther King didn't say, I have a nightmare. You know, people were living the nightmare. He had a dream. And we don't talk enough about, there's so much innovation that's been uncorked now of how cool it'll be to live like that, you know? And so
Yeah.
much of our fiction is all the future is always dystopian. And it
So
doesn't
true.
have to be utopian. It can't be perfect, but it could be protopian. It can be, hey, at least we're moving in the right direction,
Yeah.
and all's not lost, you know?
So jumping off of that, because as I mentioned before, I am the type to like, I just panic and I'm like, the world is burning and everything's terrible. What are some things that give you hope? What are some things that we can talk about at drop off that are like, hey, here's a cool thing.
Well, I'd start with the idea that before the Paris Climate Accords in 2015, the world was burning so much of what I call carbon Godzilla, just making this monster in the sea and the sky bigger and bigger, that we were on track to for like 4 to 5 degrees of warming Celsius. That's 10 degrees Fahrenheit. That's basically the movie Dune, you know,
Oh
come to
God.
life.
Yeah.
For the people who live in the tropics, right? Like it's
Ooh.
unlivable. You can't go outside. That is probably a mass extinction, human extinction event, you know. Since the Paris Accords, it's now 2.6. Not great, not perfect. We're going to lose a lot of reefs at that rate, a lot of land ice, but it's much better than the hell we were careening towards, you know? And that just happened a lot of. And that is just when people started paying attention to it, right? And for most of human history, what caused this problem is we are very clever species who figured out tools to help us work and then just burned whatever was available to make those tools run, whether it was dung or peat or whales or trees or coal and kerosene. And it's just the cheapest. And now, up until recently, the cheapest slash quote unquote cleanest was natural gas. But now the levelized cost of energy for the first time in human history, the two cheapest things are solar power with storage or onshore wind. And you don't have to imagine, wouldn't it be nice if a sustainable fuel was cheaper. It is now because of a sort of an invisible, just technical industrial revolution that brought all those things down. That learning by doing, people get better, and thus it gets cheaper, and all of that. It's just taken off, and that is why Texas is the greenest state in the country. I bet you
That's
didn't know that.
crazy to
Isn't
me.
that crazy? Texas is number one in wind, and they're installing more solar than California and Florida. Because the economics are, Trump, the ideology, and the politics in a place like Texas, which has their own grid, their own energy grid. So it's not like they're getting a perk from Colorado, doing the right thing. They're on their own grid. And a couple of Sundays ago, there was so much wind and sun in Texas, electricity was free for 6 hours. And now the challenge is, and what is drawing people to there is, now we got to store it. I mean, it's awesome that that happens, but now you get these peaks and troughs of free and expensive energy. Well, now there's all these ideas on how to store this energy, not just with lithium batteries, but with big rocks and boxes, like chunks of carbon that get glowing white hot, that are so hot that just off of sun and wind power, you can make steel with them or run a factory with them. You can use liquid to move the heat or light. You can crack open the box, like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, the light that beams out of it. You can catch that with a solar panel. And like there's all
Crazy.
these just simple, basic ideas that if once they're scaled up and industry moves into these sun and wind belts, will redefine the roadmap and trillions will be made in cleaner technologies and just ways and things that we're not yet talking about.
That's amazing. That's wild though. Like, because that's the type of thing that like I just would never have been able to conceptualize or understand. And like
Yeah.
that's really cool.
It is really cool. And it's not the narrative that you hear. I think three of the five greenest states for renewable energy are Republican-led, states. Iowa's huge for wind, the Dakotas. So much of the environmental movement for years was stopping stuff. You know, the original NIMBYs, the not in my backyards, were anti-nuke protesters.
Yeah.
These days, it's been flipped, and it's mostly like rich white homeowners who are NIMBYs who are trying to stop solar farms or wind turbines.
Yeah.
And but most polls show, regardless of party, a vast majority of Americans are fine with having these projects nearby, especially if they get the energy in their homes, you know,
yeah.
as long as you're not shipping it off to some selling it somewhere else. And, you know, agrivoltaics, which is a fancy word for basically letting livestock graze between your solar panels, you know, is just gives a whole new revenue stream to farmers who have this land. And you don't have to ruin new wilderness with, you know, these things. You can use existing land. So there's so many creative solutions that are popping up and so much energy and innovation pouring into green sectors right now that I wake up with more wonder than worry. And if I had turned this book in when it was due a couple of years ago, it honestly would have been a lot darker.
Yeah.
But enough has happened, enough events on the ground. And I've met enough really inspiring folks that it's sort of like, yeah, when we think globally, act locally, sometimes we get hung up on things are so bad globally, we just want to crawl into a ball. But if we act locally in those times, turn that anxiety into action, and that decision amplified, I think people can really make a difference.
I love that. And that's what I think is something that's so great about your book is that you have these kind of like human stories within it as well, that you're like, here are concrete examples that I can give you. It's not just, I have hope. It's like, no,
right.
I have hope and I can back it up. And like, here's examples of like people who are working together here to do this cool thing. And here's how it's helped. And like, and I actually like was copying down things and sending it to my husband. I was like, we should do this pre-cooling thing in our house this summer.
That's awesome. That's the best thing I wanted to hear. Cause yeah, there's just practical stuff. It's one thing to opine or whatever, but a lot of people are like, okay, well tell me what to do. Like, what should I do? What should I think about? And I was asking myself those questions and meeting these amazing people who were inspired either to try to build a hurricane proof house. Cause they wrote out a hurricane or wanted to build the first solar town in America. And, you know, and so we can learn so much from these pioneers of good ideas.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I am very excited for this book. And I think it's such a, I think often with books about climate change or the environment or things like that, it can be very kind of like pigeonholed for a specific customer, right? It's like the people who are already researching climate change and things like that, like they're the ones looking. But this one feels very much like a for everyone book. Like it's not like I'm very much not a science person. And I was able to read this book. Like I was able to understand what was going on. And like I was like, oh, this makes sense. So
yeah,
I think that's the type of book that we need. So that we can have people like me going, let me try this pre-cooling thing. And, oh, this gives me hope. And, you know, maybe I won't catastrophize completely. So I definitely appreciate the style of this book and that it is kind of widely, it will have wide appeal, I think.
That means so much to hear because when you, this is my first book and you don't know if your first baby's ugly until you start walking it around the neighborhood. And so you cringe waiting to see people's reactions. And so it's really gratifying to hear that. And that's awesome. And because I was worried because it is sort of a non-definable sort of genre mashup of all these various biography, autobiography, home cooling tips.
Right. Yeah.
thank you for saying that.
Yeah, of course. And as we kind of wrap up here, I wonder if you could share like one tip that listeners could maybe do in their own lives to help with climate change on any level. What would that one tip be?
You know, there's a bunch of practical, you know, if you're remodeling your home, I got a whole bunch of stuff on that or to, you know, think about your diet and, you know, really examining regenerative agriculture, all of that. But when people ask me, like, give me a tip, what can I do? I say, well, what do you love? Like, the thing about this problem is, like, much the way my climate beat touches everything, you can help in so many ways and use your strengths and your passions, right? And if you are and really around the idea that you want to plug into your ecosystem, your environment, where you live, what is your air quality? Where does your water come from? What is your utility? Who runs your utility? Who's on the board? How are they making those decisions? Some people who are super engaged in civics and would want to go to meetings would use that strength to keep the rest of the neighborhood apprised of what the utility commission is deciding, you know, and how we can leverage, how we can maybe influence that with our voices. If you're an accountant, you can lend those skills, and you love birds, you can lend those skills to a nonprofit that's, you know, bringing back species. If you really are into environmental justice, can work with less, you know, privileged kids who live in pollution zones and get them in into the woods and take them hiking. You know, like my, I just want people to, in a time of isolation and polarization, just to reconnect around the basics at the bottom of our pyramids. And when we do that, and when you get together, one thing I espouse is this idea of beavers are making a huge comeback as these landscape water engineers. When you reintroduce beavers, it can bring back watersheds in dramatic ways. And even in places without beavers, by mimicking them, by building beaver dam analogs, they're called, with neighbors, you can slow down water, you can revive ecosystems, and all it takes is natural found materials and a little, you know, friendship and cooperation. And over those projects and conversations, you can talk about ballot initiatives, you can talk about candidates, you can talk about companies you think we should be rewarding. And it just becomes part of your overall conversation, you know, like, and instead of letting somebody strip away the friction in life, lean into it a little more to say, no, where did this come from? Where is this clothing made? Who made it? You know, how long should I think about, you know, the hidden costs of these things? I'm just hoping to spark conversations like that.
I think that's great, and I think that will happen with this book. I hope so.
I hope so too.
Bill, thank you so much. I'm so excited for Life as We Know It Can Be. By the time this interview goes up, it will be out. So congratulations.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you so much. And I'd love
And
to
best
drop
of
by
luck.
and maybe see it on your shelf in person one of these days and shake
You're
your hand
welcome
because you're really
anytime.
easy to talk to. Thanks for
Oh,
having
thank you.
me.
Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thanks.
Bye.
Huge thanks again to Bill Weir for joining me on the podcast. Life as We Know It Can Be is available now from Gibson's Bookstore, and I'll put that link in the show notes. You can email us about the podcast at thelaydownpodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gibsonsbookstore.com/laydown-books. Make sure you're following us on your favorite social media platforms. We're on most of them, and all of those links will be in the show notes. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode, and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the bookstore. Bye!